Okay, thanks everybody, and welcome to another edition of Conversations with Dr. Cowan and Friends. And today I have a new friend who I've spoken to a few times. Actually, I don't even know your last name. It's Michael.
Obenis, yeah.
Yeah, so Michael will introduce himself in a minute. So the people who listen to my podcast, Michael, are, I think, used to me talking about health issues because, you know, I'm supposed to be a doctor. So that's like supposed to be what I'm talking about. So this is, in some ways, one could say, because it's about mortgages, liens, government, freedom, you know, what our, quote, rights are. That's not probably the wrong way to say it. Etc. One could say, what does this have to do with health? So I want to address that first, because I actually think it has a lot to do with health. I actually think it has more to do with health than just about most other things we talk about. So I'm going to give three examples of why I think it has to do with health. Even if it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And, you know, like I often tell my guests, if you hear anything that you don't agree with or want to correct, please do so. Maybe not right then, but because the last conversation we had, I summarized what I had heard from the previous one with Michael. And I think you said I got 65% right, which in most tests would be a resound flunk. So if that's the best I can do, that's not so good. But anyways, I'll do here. Here's my intro then. So the first thing is, and again, I'm only partly sure about this, but I think the group or the organization or whatever it is actually that you work with actually challenged the government when they had decided, the English government decided to cull chickens. Like millions of chickens based on the alleged infection with some sort of bird flu. I think you're part of that. You could correct me if I'm wrong.
I am, yes. I co-drafted the remedy for that.
Yes. So what happened, as far as I understand, is that they had essentially said they were going to do something. And then you told them about your remedy for this. And as far as I know, that's the last we heard of it. And they didn't, in fact, kill a bunch of people's chickens. And so that's a huge victory and a huge health concern because there is no bird flu virus. That's for one thing. And a lot of people didn't have to lose their livelihood or their property or they're even beloved chickens. I mean, I have chickens and we care for them even if they're not laying. So that's a health concern. And even then people don't have eggs or chicken to eat, you know, and so that's also a health concern. The second one is, and again, you can weigh in on this eventually if you disagree or see it differently, it's fine. But I think that what we think matters. And one of the reasons I think that is because I think that we live in what you could call a mind universe, or people put this in a lot of different ways, but consciousness comes first. And so we, of course, have these bodies, but I want to give an example that I think demonstrates the principle that mind or consciousness comes first. It's a little bit of a crude one, which is sort of a tendency of mine. But if you could imagine, you know, an intimate experience where somebody is, you know, massaging or rubbing a part of you that feels good, right? It could be a man or a woman. And so there's a lot of emotion and a lot of feeling and even maybe excitement and a whole lot of other things that come along with that. Now, imagine then that the same person, you know, while they're maybe in the shower or somewhere, rubs that same part of them, mostly to clean themselves off. So same motion, same pressure, same tension, same connection. And most of people would say they feel nothing because you're just washing your various body parts. And so what's interesting about that example to me is the meaning and the whole experience of that is not in that body part, it's in your mind, right? Totally. It's got nothing to do with like your breast. Of course, it has something to do with your breast. I just contradicted myself. The breast becomes a, or whatever, becomes a sort of part of that drama. But the meaning of it is what we give it to in our minds. I think that's clear. So what we think and what's in our mind and how we conceive of our what freedom is and government is and rights are and even what a mortgage is makes a huge difference. And it's only that that's going to inspire our actions. And the other thing that it struck me about this is most of us in the no virus community, if you want to call it that, we're also in the sovereignty, freedom, looking at these issues, where does money come from and what is a contract and all that. Whereas, and we don't believe that the solution to this is like less corrupt government officials, right? Whereas the other part of the so-called truth and freedom movement who believes in viruses, they think, well, let's get the right person in there and he'll clean up the corruption and we'll be all fine and all that. And so there's a real split. And I think the split is because we in the no virus movement have learned to look at the facts and think in what I would call properly, guided by the reality and the facts. And the other side is unfortunately still guided by superstitions and what they believed in myths and what they learned in their education and all that stuff. So that's the second reason. What we think matters. What we think becomes actions. Actions become our lives in a way. The third example, I did this in a group I was with yesterday. I said to the person in the group, I was so I said, I actually have a nephew who's a little down in his luck, and so I pointed to one of the guys who's in the group, and I said, could you give him your hat? And he said, sure. Yeah, I'll give him my hat. And so I said, good. Could you also give him $10,000 because he's a little down in his luck and not able to pay his mortgage? And he said, I'm not so sure I want to do that. And I said, yeah, but Fred, we took a vote amongst all the people in the group, and there's 30 people, and 16 said that you need to give the guy $10,000 because he's down in his luck. And 16 was more than 14, so the majority says you got to give him $10,000. And he said, I don't know if I want to do that. And I said, yeah, but Fred, you see this piece of paper? We got this paper here, and a bunch of people with wigs, years ago, they signed this paper. And the paper says that you need to give this guy $10,000. So go ahead and do it. And he said, I don't know if I want to do that. I said, yeah, but a bunch of us signed this paper, and so you need to do this. Because if you don't do it, we have this guy, he's got this gun, and he's going to go over to your house and he's going to tell you that you need to do this. And what was it? The reason I bring that up is I asked him, obviously, this was a sort of a joke because I had no intention of doing that, but I asked him how he felt. And he said, I got increasingly anxious through this procedure and more uncomfortable. And I'm going to finish here because I would contend that those exact reasons are what the situation we're living in. Like somebody signed this piece of paper, or the majority of people. And if you put, say, you need to give like 40% of your wealth or your property to somebody who says they want you to, or they're going to come to your house and take it from you. And that is a very anxiety producing way to live. And it doesn't feel good. And I would contend that since a lot of health and illness is in our heads or mind, not in our heads, sorry, that living under that threat and that anxiety is not good for our health. And even though we may not know that we're living there, we are. That's just the reality. And the people who see the no virus position see this as well. That's why so many of us are part of that. And I think I've gone on enough. And so, welcome, Michael. And if you could, I don't know if you have any comments or anything, but introduce yourself and what you're doing and whatever you think is relevant to help people understand what's going on here and what we need to do next. So, thanks for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me. First and foremost, before I make an attempt to introduce myself, which is never easy, and you'll see why in a minute, I agree with everything that you said, and it's great to hear it broken down like that. And I particularly liked the way you introduced people to the concept of mob rule, which they don't see as being the same thing as democracy, but of course it is. And that is why democracy necessarily means that freedom cannot exist with democracy. It cannot, because the whichever ruling authority takes power will always oppress the ones who oppose it. So therefore, not everyone can be free in a democracy. And you can't say it's freedom for just the electorate who voted in the party that's in power. You can't say that they're free just because they voted for whatever the system is. So I think I just wanted to make that point before going into an introduction. The people who are listening who know nothing about me will probably think that I come from some kind of legal or analytical kind of profession. And that is because I was forced through necessity to defend my family from significant frauds by a major UK bank, which resulted in me getting sucked into a dispute for 9 years. But before we get into any of that, that resulted in me doing a lot of legal research and a lot of other research into the way the world actually worked. And I've always been someone who was able to identify what complex problems were and how to go about resolving them. And sometimes this will involve doing things that, are unfortunate or unpleasant, and other times they'll be very enjoyable. But mainly, I have a way of identifying what the issues are and how they can be resolved. And because of this, I ended up looking at the overall picture in the world and deciding that it wasn't fixable. The problems in the on the earth are so endemic, and it's by design, there's no doubt about that, but they're so endemic, there's no way that we could ever hope to fix all of the issues. Therefore, the only way forward is to build a new advanced civilization that will make the old one obsolete. Now, that's because the old one is completely tyrannical and fraudulent in nature and has been designed that way in order to keep us all slaves to a debt-based finance system, which is again designed to keep us down and to keep us as tax slaves. And we'll come back to various remedies that I have devised over the years that and helped other people to use to, well, put it this way, to make it easier to navigate the system, no matter how tyrannical it becomes. However, the overall picture would be that to put it in a nutshell, what I've done over the past 15 years is with a load of other like-minded people, predominantly in the UK, but across the world now in many different territories, we've created an organization called Universal Community Trust, and we created it by international treaty. And it's a treaty that I know you've read, Tom, and you've been very positive about. And that's because what it did was it used international law and convention to create a jurisdiction that is government-free tax-free, and where all free indigenous peoples on the earth can coexist under a system of law that basically breaks down to one simple summary that covers everything. Do no harm, but accept no injury, harm, or damage from any other party, including government. And what it means is that under UCT jurisdiction, it's simply impossible for what you described to happen. In other words, nobody goes around saying, because of this piece of paper that you didn't consent to, we can do this. Because under UCT jurisdiction, that cannot happen.
So
Is
just to
that
clarify, so UCT stands for,
Universal Community Trust?
and that's the name of the what I want to get the word right. The organization, is that right?
It's the name of the organization. It's also the name of the jurisdiction, and it's also the name of a trust that was created to form all of that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm with you so far. I think I got it.
Okay, so in tandem
And
with the
maybe
creation.
just because somebody asked me, what did you do? If I don't know, it to me it's not that important what you did before this. Like, were you a carpenter or a school teacher or something? Or I mean, just for interest's sake.
Well, no, it is worth pondering. I've been a filmmaker for the past 30 years, since I was in my mid-20s, and I've done the whole international producing bit, and I had a fair degree of success. But on account of the information that I picked up about 9/11, 3 days after 9/11 happened, about who actually did it, who was the architect, who was the commissioner who paid for it, what was the name of the deal that they fraudulently used to pay all of the operatives, how did they get the operatives together, who was bringing them together, what were they training them to do? I found all of that out from the ex-wife of Kissinger's right-hand man looking for someone to tell her story 3 days after 9/11. She happened upon me, and she told me
Wow.
things that she'd only ever told one other person. And because of that, I was put on the MI5 subversives list, and I have ended up getting blacklisted because I was on the brink of having a very, very successful international career in the film industry. And they literally did blacklist me at a banking level.
Wow.
So
And
that's what I used to do.
who I hadn't heard that. Who is this person? This the ex-wife of Kissinger's.
The ex-wife of Kissinger's right-hand man,
Wow.
for 20 odd years, and they attempted to assassinate her in the blowing up of the US Embassy in Nairobi in 98. They were attempting to kill her in that, but she survived and told her story.
Wow. I just want to point out here too, Michael, that this is, again, as I alluded to in the beginning, I think, again, and I keep saying this, but correct me if I get any of this wrong. But this is a fundamental distinction, which I must agree I share with you, between those who believe that the system is reformable, that we need better laws, better people, more honest people. You know, we need to audit the Fed. You know, it goes on and on and on of the things that supposedly we could do, which of course never happened, you know, but even if they did happen. Like, even the best case scenario in that situation won't work. It won't accomplish like people being free to live as they are meant to. Therefore, I mean, as you say, the only other solution, because it's not reformable by design, is to make a different system. That's the split. And that's the split in the truth and freedom community, which I use that truth and freedom because I don't see how it's truth and freedom. But anyways, that's a different story.
Yes.
That's the
Well,
difference.
if I could add to that, I think there is also another split, only that there are very few people in one of these camps and a lot of people in the other. I think there are too many intellectual divisions, to be honest, which don't serve any of us very well. Because when it comes down to it, we know that there are so few who walk the walk as well as talking the talk. And that's one of the things that we've specialized in UCT. We don't just talk the talk, we actually do it. And that's why we're looking for nation builders. We're not looking for people who just want a nicer version of the welfare state, because that's not what UCT is. UCT is a template to build an advanced civilization that will not even confront the old system in any way. It will simply illuminate how obsolete it is by advancing way beyond it. And the only reason this is possible is because the old system and any system that the controllers of it could ever set up or would ever set up is always going to have elements that will always keep the masses in place. And that would mean necessarily that freedom couldn't exist.
Got it. Okay. So, at the risk of a stupid question, Michael, what's wrong with the current system? Isn't democracy, aren't we fighting for our freedom? I can hardly even get the words out of my mouth, but I'm supposed to be an interviewer, so that's the question. What's
If
wrong
the
with it?
system was a car, and you took it for an appraisal, they would say it doesn't work. It doesn't. It doesn't do any of the things that it's supposed to at all, except oppress people or allow people to be oppressed. It allows certain elite to do, self-appointed, by the way, to do certain things, and it allows certain underlings of the self-appointed elite to do other things. But when it comes down to it, I've seen it. The higher up the greasy pole you go, the more treacherous it becomes, the more guaranteed it is that sooner or later someone's going to ask you to do something that qualifies as selling your soul and signing your name in blood at the same time. I've experienced it myself. I know what it's like. They will say to you, look, you can have a guarantee of success. Every reviewer will absolutely love your work. You'll never struggle for money. Everybody will love you. Or you can open your mouth and say what you like, and then all of that will turn to shit and you'll be blacklisted. And I have to say, I would never even consider the other path because I chose the blacklist and I know I was doing it because without truth, there can't be freedom. And if the people who are in positions of responsibility in the media can't tell the truth, then the whole world is in serious trouble.
So maybe summarize then, besides that corruption, what's wrong with the sort of typical democratic parliamentary system or the system, whatever you want to call it, that we live under now?
Well, there are so many things, it's difficult to
Yeah,
know
I
where to
know.
start,
That's
but
an impossible question, really. But anyways, if you could. Let's imagine somebody who's just like, are you kidding me? Like democracy is the god. I just did a piece called Democracy, the God That Failed. I stole that from the name of a book, but anyways, yeah.
but democracy doesn't work because, as I was alluding to before, the democratic victor will always oppress the supporters of the losing side. So, and they will have no choice but to adhere to whatever the policies are of the democratic victor. But the democratic victor is always just the same as a victor in mob rule. So someone gets a mob together and gangs up on the rest of the crowd, and they say, this is what has to happen, otherwise we'll beat the shit out of you. I mean, that's literally what democracy
Right.
is. And the other thing is, it's actually not a very good thing to ask a lot of people what to do on important issues. It's not. It's like you don't have 25 directors on a film set, otherwise you would have absolute bedlam. You have people who are great at doing lots of different things at an advanced level, but each role is clearly defined. And in democracy, they want to pretend that we can all be the same. And that is literally an impossibility, the way we're made. So without getting into any of that, I also have to say that the biggest problem with democracy is there isn't a choice. They give you two faces of the same coin.
Yeah.
And the words might sound different, the colors might be different, but it all comes down to the same thing. The same self-appointed elite who are all banking families retain power. They retain control of all the political apparatus, and they have had control of that since the Frankfurt School began hundreds of years ago, when they literally created the two sides of the same coin, socialism and capitalism, and they wanted people to think they were different when each one requires the same control at the top by the self-appointed elite of bankers. Now, the reason why this is so critically important to all the problems in the world, in the so-called democratic world, is because currently, in all but Sharia banking and perhaps a few other countries, other BRICS nations besides, there is not one single example that I have seen, and I've been working in the field of fighting mortgage fraud for the best part of the last 15 years. And I have seen thousands and thousands of mortgages from all over the world, and I'm yet to see a single mortgage that wasn't entirely fraudulent in nature. And every single economy in every so-called democratic nation is founded upon not just those fraudulent mortgages, but a fraudulent financial system, which is fraudulent the world over, and yet everyone pretends that it isn't, because no one in positions of responsibility and power ever allows the truth to be known by the masses, and lots of people have died over that issue. So
All
there
right,
is another huge problem.
can you walk us through the, so, you probably know I'm big on finding the claim and then substantiating the evidence for the claim. So let's do that. So you made the claim that let me try to get this right. All of the mortgages that are written in, let's call it the US and England, right, are fraudulent. Is that
Yes.
correct?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Now, so show prove that to us, or
Okay.
what do you mean by that?
So, for fraud to take place, the
Maybe
elements
define fraud first.
Yes, I have to define, that's what I'm doing now.
Okay.
So, for fraud to take place, party A has to rely upon a dishonest statement or fail to disclose to party B something that the other party had a right to know. So, the reason why every single mortgage that I've seen from the US or England has been fraudulent has been there has not been one single mortgage that I've seen that involved the bank doing what it pretended it was doing. So, it relied upon the dishonest statement that it was lending its own money to its customer. In every case, when the truth was, and still is, that the bank was stealing the credit created by the customer's note or promissory note that they executed prior to getting the so-called loan to buy the house, etc. And literally, what really happens is the bank takes that note, deposited it, or deposits it in a securities account unbeknown to the customer. Then they transfer that credit back to the bank where the customer holds their account, and they then pretend that they lent their own money to the customer, who then has to pay back the credit that their note created at compound interest for the next 25 years if they don't lose their house and get foreclosed.
So,
So that is why, go on.
yeah, back us through what do you mean by a promissory note? So let's go through that process. So person A says, I want to buy this house for $500,000. What
No,
happens next?
it's much more simplistic than that, Tom. A
Okay.
promissory note, there are many different types, but I'm talking specifically about a promissory note that is made payable to bearer. A promissory note made payable to bearer is just as good as cash in the hands of the banker. So what they do is they get you to sign a note that is payable in the hands of any banker so it can easily be sold on in various securities, in forms of securities and bundles of securities. Now, a promissory note is simply one person promising to pay another a certain sum of money at a certain date or to bearer on demand, if it's a bearer note, as I was describing. Now, it's simple. It's just a promise to pay. It's not the actual money, but the thing is, since we came off the gold standard in England in 31, in America in 33, and I know there were other versions of notes that were backed by commodities later than that, but as of the present date and for several decades at the very least, there has been nothing that created money in this world save for promissory notes of various descriptions and kinds and natures that are deposited by bankers to create the funds in the accounts which they pretend are their own funds that they've either created or they're loaning to the customer, when the banks cannot operate. They cannot create this credit without having the customers execute the notes and then they steal them to create the credit.
So, tell me if this is right then. So, again, if you decide to buy this piece of property from somebody, you unbeknownst to you generate a promissory note saying you will pay this amount of money to the seller, right?
Yes.
And
In essence, go on.
the bank takes that promissory note. So you made a promise to pay for a certain amount of money for this house because you want to live there.
Yes.
You didn't know you did that, but that allows the bank to take that promissory note and essentially go to a securities, some institution or something, and that allows them to generate the money to pay off the seller.
Yes, and there's only one thing that is missing, but it's a critical element that's missing. What should be happening is whoever wants to buy the property issues the promissory note at exactly the same value, but without any interest payable. They give it to the vendor. The vendor then gives it to their bank. Their bank takes deposit of it, gives the vendor the credit, and that's it. The house is bought and paid for, without anything to pay. But what's happening is the bank is stealing the note and pretending that they're lending their own funds to the buyer. It isn't happening.
So it would be the bank then in your ideal scenario, it would be the bank of the vendor who generates the money from that promissory note.
Well, if you look upon a bank generating the money when you place cash or a check in an account, then yes. But it's simply that the vendor's bank will take deposit of the instrument that creates the credit instead of the other bank stealing the credit and pretending it's lending it to the buyer.
Do you the seller pay back that 500,000 with no interest
No,
to?
since the abolition of all of the commodity standards, the only type of money we have in this world is money created by promissory notes, debt instruments of various descriptions. And so what I'm saying is the promissory note is the only form of money we have in that debt-based system, the only form of money. But they pretend otherwise, obviously, to keep
So
it going.
in the way you're saying it should be, you wouldn't be out any money at all, or
No,
except
exactly.
the
There wouldn't be
promissory.
anything to pay. It would
So
all be paid off.
who decide how would it be decided who gets which house?
No, it's simple. The note is the payment. The vendor accepts it. That's it. It's bought and paid for. There's no decision to be made. It's a simple transaction.
This may be a stupid question again, but one of the reasons why certain people get certain houses, I think, is because they, at least we think that I have the money to pay for it and you don't. So what you're saying is people would then get the house that they want because we have the inherent right in this system to create money.
Correct. And that's why we've set up our own jurisdiction under UCT to create a credit-based system of banking, which will be exactly like that.
So in that system, the thing that that would determine which house you get is just which house you want.
Of course, yes.
What if
Nothing
you
else.
want 10 houses?
Well, then you'd have to justify why you wanted 10 houses, and you unless you were doing good things with them, it wouldn't fly. So, not in other words, we won't let people take the piss, as it were.
Who, yeah, that's who decides whether it's a good thing or not? That's an interesting question.
Well, it depends what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it's so. Okay, I think I got it. So, whatever the new system is, the old system is clearly fraudulent because they don't tell you that they're stealing your promissory note and using that to generate the funds.
That's right, yes.
So that's the fraud.
Yes, that's the fraud. They're stealing the credit and pretending it's a loan.
And telling you that you are, it's not yours, it's theirs, and then they charge you interest just to rub it in a little bit.
Well, they claim a charge over it, and that means that if you go into default, then they can foreclose, yes.
Got it. And so I know you've had some experience, even though it's, I think, difficult to inform them, and maybe that's not the right word, that this is fraudulent and there, it has been paid, and you don't have any claim on making me pay this mortgage back or whatever.
Well, the banks at the highest level, they or rather the bankers at the highest level and the professors of banking, they have absolutely no disagreement with the way I describe it all works. Their problem with the system is that the system refuses to accept that it is all run fraudulently. And it has been for so long that it's like not only does nobody at the high enough level have an understanding of it, but the people who do, they are making so much money from it that they're never going to let it stop. So going to the banks, well, we can get the directors of each UK commercial bank to agree that they need reform in their policy to get rid of a company policy which is tantamount to mortgage fraud on an industrial scale that we've been fighting for, as I say, for 15 years. And we got to the point where it was all agreed by the directors of every UK commercial bank that they should change their policy to get rid of this fraudulent practice. And they were stopped, and we didn't have it disclosed to us who stopped it, but it looked very much like the Bank of England and the Financial Conduct Authority, who were supposed to be overseeing the industry and making sure that fraud wasn't being practiced. They were making sure that it continued. So with fraud going on at that level and being protected at that level by a central bank, you just know you can see that this what that there's no point in lobbying them for change. We've long had a proposal for nearly 3 years or 2 years now. We've had a proposal at the Home Secretary's office, which was read by at least one Home Secretary, probably two, that was a simple amendment to mortgage law in the UK that they agreed to in principle, but the Bank of England and the FCA blocked because it would have ended industrial scale mortgage fraud, industrialized mortgage fraud. And the very crimes that we've been fighting for all this time that we've exposed with so many bundles of evidence. You get to a point where you realize that there's no point banging your head against a wall anymore. The system is endemically corrupt and fraudulent. It cannot be fixed. We need a new one. So focusing on the things that we can create to replace all that has been a lot easier than fighting the system.
Got it. So, in other words, they again. Let me say, try see if I can say this. So, the people at the top that you've communicated with understand this level of fraud. They understand that the fraud is essentially how they do business. But and maybe even if certain individuals wanted to change it, they're simply not allowed to change it by the most high in the banking world, which is the central bankers.
Yes, and one man in particular who supported us in this cause, a guy called Anthony Stansfeld, who used to be the Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner, and he's very, very popular, got a great record, and he's a very tough talker where fraud's concerned. And what he said in an interview that he gave to me a few years ago was that having had experience get rooting out the corruption in the Hong Kong police force for 3 years, where he got rid of the mafia and survived. That's a big accolade in and of itself. And he came back here, and I asked him, so how did the City of London corruption when you came back from Hong Kong compare with the crime in the Hong Kong police force? And he said, it doesn't compare. The City of London is at least 10 times worse. And he's gone on to say that it's much worse than that, because he's seen how endemic the frauds are. It doesn't matter how high profile someone is, even at his level, he's presented all our evidence to the governments, multiple governments, every single one of the chief regulators, and none of them have been prepared to do anything. And we've even got evidence that doesn't only suggest, we've got evidence which proves that the UK government has had a policy for more than a decade of making sure that fraud never got ruled by any judge in the courts in Britain, to make sure that the bankers were protected from this ever getting out. So
Yeah.
we really have exhausted all the remedies.
Right. So, and this is a huge issue for like common normal people because, you know, a huge part of one's economic health and wealth is tied up with their property, their house, and their mortgage, right? So this is a
Yes.
huge deal.
Exactly.
And what I think, what again, correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying is there. And I assume this would be the same in the United States, is that there is no remedy in the system for this. They are simply not going to change. Therefore, you started to look for a different system outside, a different way of doing business outside of the system.
Yes, we started looking for ways to do things in a much more simplistic form, using some of their methods, but using the methods that we adopted in a way that protects the person or the business, as opposed to leaving them wide open for fraud from the off, which is the way things have been for so long. And we looked at ways to use the promissory note to create credit and to use other debt instruments to create credit instead of creating debt, because we saw that there
Can you
were.
flesh out what you mean by that? Using promissory notes to create credit instead of debt.
Okay, so in the present system, as I was explaining, the mortgage fraud involves taking a promissory note that belongs to the mortgagor and stealing the credit that is created by depositing it in a securities account. So I looked at that transaction. I thought, right, I'm going to get in contact with a private bank. So this is 2011. No, sorry, 2010. I got in contact with the head of HSBC Private Bank in Leeds in the UK. And because I can talk the right language, he was willing to have a conversation with me, because I'd put a proposition to him in writing, which he'd agreed to in principle, but I wanted to talk to him just to walk him through it, just to check that he had that he knew exactly what I was proposing. So he agreed. I said to him, is it right that you have now agreed in principle to accept deposit of an instrument called a promissory note made payable to bearer, made by me and deposited in a private securities account that you're going to open for me as an individual to create a line of credit at the value of those notes? And he said, well, subject to you providing me with proof that you have fixed assets of any nature, including commercial paper fixed assets, of at least the value that you want to create in credit, then yes, we can do that. So we got as far as me providing the evidence that we had, that I was entitled to at least £2.5 million worth of fixed assets. He accepted them, but unfortunately, there was a claim by a bank, a fraudulent claim by a bank against those assets. And he said, until you get rid of that claim, we can't proceed. But everything
Do
was
you
agreed in
did you
principle. Now,
consider that an onerous request or a reasonable request?
I can, well, put it this way. Had there been no fraudulent mortgages over the properties, it would have been done there and then. So I was
Yeah.
extremely encouraged by that.
So
But I was.
not to interrupt here, but you would have seen that as a reasonable request. Like, I can show you that I have assets or for $500,000, and then I can deposit this promise this, use this promissory note, and you, banker, are good with that.
Yes. Yes. In other words, it was an obvious thing for them to ask for.
Yeah.
But at the same time, to confirm the credit is created like that, and it, then that it leaves no debt, and that the fixed assets remain fixed. That's why they're called fixed assets. In other words, what I discovered was that high net worth individuals, for an awfully long time, have been able to say to their banker, look, I've got fixed assets way in excess of how much money I need. Can I draw up a promissory note and deposit it to create that line of credit against those fixed assets, which prove, you know, that I'm good for the credit? Yes, you can. But the instruments themselves were the money. They weren't drawn upon the assets. In other words, this is why when I was in the film, well, I still am in the film industry, but when I was actually working with the banks, we had a letter of credit that was drawn up against fixed assets of a film investor that were valued in excess of $9.5 million. And we had a letter of credit, an irrevocable one, by Bank Hapoalam in Switzerland for $9.5 million. And when I asked the investor if he was going to lose $9.5 million of his fixed assets, he said, oh no, this is a different type of banking entirely. In other words, this is the way the bankers will do banking, and they'll allow their favorites to do the same, or they'll assist them to do the same. And even though hardly anybody in the world understands it, this is the way banking has been done for a very long time. So what we did was we took those mechanisms under UCT jurisdiction, and we filtered out all of the fraudulent elements, and we just kept the ones that create the credit without logging a debt. In other words, we simply say, right, instead of a debt that can never be paid back being created by this credit in someone's log, we will simply create the credit with the instrument, and there's no debt attached to it. And once you get your head around this, you see just how endemic the frauds are in the other system. You really do.
Got it. And so presumably that would lead to the, I don't know if you call them members or participants or citizens, I doubt, of the UCT, they would end up, because you're, I think, going to actually acquire a bank that can do this security exchange, these members would be able to create their own credit and live debt-free and acquire assets that they can use productively and happily.
Correct, yes. We're in the process, and it's been a long time in the making, but we're in the process of acquiring a fully operational, licensed bank with international capabilities in order to become UCT Treasuries Bank. Now, once we're up and running, we already have commercial paper valued in excess of £34 billion in two tranches that we will deposit as our fixed assets. And this is just commercial paper, but the commercial paper is made up from promissory notes from real people within UCT, but also for something called it's a tranche of liens. And I'll need to explain exactly what a lien is, because a lien is something that is created through a process that I've devised called the common law lien process, which is a common law defense to any form of civil wrongdoing, particularly fraud. And we have a tranche of £17 billion worth of lien creditors who have perfected lien processes against the CEOs of virtually every UK bank that peddles fraudulent mortgages. And all of these liens have been checked out by top legal minds, top accounting minds, and various people in accounting and auditing. And they've all come to the same conclusions. And that is that this lien, following the correct process, once 90 days is logged from the date the lien is served upon the lien debtor, it becomes an account receivable and is treated at law in exactly the same way an equitable mortgage is. In other words, capable of being deposited and creating credit. So what we did is we took the lien process, which is effectively a common law process by anyone who's been defrauded by a bank over a fraudulent mortgage. And we've turned the lien process into a form of credit which will pay back the damages owed to all the lien creditors. Now, I know that's very difficult to understand, so I can't repeat any element of that if required.
I'm almost intimidated to try to put that in my own words, so to help people understand it. But so the banks, and in the particularly the CEO, the person who is essentially responsible at the bank, he or she has been has done fraud. Therefore, you can serve them a lien saying, because you have acted fraudulently against me or Fred or somebody else, we serve you with a lien of $1 million. And if you don't do anything about it for 90 days, which they probably won't, then that becomes essentially, like you were describing with a promissory note, something that can be deposited in this new bank, and that can be the vehicle for creating credit for the person, presumably, who won't be paid back by the CEO.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's
Wow.
a way of creating the credit that will pay the damages that the CEO will never pay to the creditor, if you see
So,
what I
in other
mean.
words, the creditor who has been out $1 million because he's been defrauded now gets his $1 million or £1 million to use to buy his house or something, a car.
Yes, exactly. And I think I should also just clarify a little bit about what, because there's a more simplistic way and I can explain what a lien is. The most common form of lien is a solicitor's lien. And a solicitor's lien is a lien right to hold on to property that a client has left with them until a bill is paid. Another common form of lien is a mechanic's lien, which is an automatic common law lien right to hold on to, again, someone else's property if they haven't paid a bill. A banker's lien, even though it's very common, it's the least known type of lien, but a banker's lien is a lien right that the bank has claimed to have on every single deposit in their bank. Now, I'm not saying that they claim to have a lien right over it to enforce for the customers. I'm saying they claim to own every single deposit, and they would enforce it and do sometimes with a lien right. So what I'm
And
putting forward here.
that's where this
Go
sort of, I think they call it bail in thing comes from, right? They
Yes, that's
say
right.
that if you deposit $10,000 in a bank, the bank s claims that they have a lien on that $10,000 for God knows what reason. And therefore, if they need the money or needs whatever it is, they can claim it and it's theirs. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it.
That's right, exactly. So, in other words, and this is the best kept secret about banking, the banking industry, for all it's founded in multiple types of fraud, it cannot function in law without the lien. So, and without the lien right being exercised routinely on a daily, if not hourly basis. So,
Why is
therefore,
that?
that is because banking, if you look at they used to call it the Bible of banking, Paget's Law of Banking, a banker writing on the law of banking, and he wrote extensively on the lien right. Halsbury is also probably the number one authority on liens. Halsbury's English Law of Liens. It goes into every different type of lien that there is. And basically, they've gotten away with it by claiming that banking couldn't survive, it couldn't operate, it couldn't function properly without exercising this lien right. And it's just simply the right to bail in. That's what it is. But they claim it, and they claim it aggressively, and they protect it aggressively. So what we did is we took something that not many people know about, the lien, and we created a new type of process which benefits the other side of the transaction only. And it doesn't leave a debt behind, it only creates a credit. But the best bit about the lien itself, I'm talking about the instrument once perfected, not only can it be deposited to create that credit, it can also be used to be registered against the legal estate of the lien debtors, i.e., the fraudulent CEOs. So you can lien up, as we call it, in other words, place a lien over the property of the lien debtor, the CEO, and you don't need to go anywhere near a court to do it. It's a common law right, and it can be enforced under common law. So that
Enforced
is another
how?
element to it. Pardon?
How is it enforced?
In the same way, a mortgage would be foreclosed. So you would, there are two types of ways this can be done. The first is you could, when you're simply taking the funds, you would do a non-possessory lien. If you wanted to take the property, it would be a possessory lien. So you would simply place a lien which is registered at the, it would be your equivalent of the land registry that we have in the UK. The lien would be registered in the same way a charge is registered over a property, and it can be done at company's house as well. I'm sure you'll have some kind of equivalent there, where you are simply registering in the public record that there is a claim over the property of the lien debtor. And you would have the right to go and seize that property if the value that they owed you for committing the fraud hadn't been paid back. In other words, if the lien hadn't been satisfied with monies, you would have the right to take the property in the same way they do to us. But we would much rather focus on the more positive outlook, creating the credit without a debt, and
Right.
making the new system to make the old one obsolete as quick as possible.
Right. Because that sounds like you would have to use some sort of force, which you don't want to get into. And
No, we don't want to
so,
get into it, but I'm just saying that that is the, it's the equivalent of that. That's how powerful it is.
Right. So rather than that, you use it to create credit, which then increases the wealth of the lien creator, so to speak.
Yes, and it's always owned by the creator of the instrument,
Got it.
so which is a big difference as well.
And this same reasoning I gather applies to car loans, personal loans, and all the rest of the loans that come from banks.
Yes, they're all 100% fraudulent. The banks and the credit agencies never lend their own funds, and we've created many different remedies to deal with them. The credit card remedy, which is often known as the three-letter process, I invented it in 2009 to get rid of a fraudulent bank loan for £27,000 at the time with HSBC. And it's a simple process. You ask the bank to deliver the evidence that that they actually lent their own funds, that there is a valid enforceable contract, and they just can't do it. And you give them more than one opportunity to provide the documents, and then you get them in default. And then once they're in default, you declare, normally under oath in an affidavit, that there is no evidence that the loan exists, and therefore they're committing fraud against you. And that's when you automatically have a lien right to pursue against the company who become the lien debtor at that point. So it's all interconnected the way we've made all the remedies.
And just on a so by doing that process, then the outcome that I think you told me has happened thousands or maybe more times is that people discharge the debt, whether it's a car loan or a credit card, and actually end up with a credit based on their lien on the fraudulent activity of the CEO of the company.
Correct. Yes, that is exactly what is happening now. And in the past, I mean, this remedy has been incredibly popular in the UK, less so now because they've tried to suppress it for obvious reasons. But I'm yet to come across anyone who doesn't say the same thing, that when it's used correctly, the three-letter process always discharges fraudulent credit card debt, but also it discharges fraudulent claims by the debt collection agents that chase fraudulent credit card debt. And it also creates a claim which can be utilized in the lien process, as you were alluding to. But also, this process has won in court when it's gone into court, because quite simply, the courts are forced to ask, when it does get that far, Well, where is the evidence that you lent your own money, that the contract was a bilateral one that was properly executed and contained properly negotiated terms and conditions? And they never can prove any of those things.
Right.
So, you don't, there's very little risk taking on credit cards or fraudulent credit cards and fraudulent loans. However, I must stress there is a big risk. There always is a big risk taking on a mortgage company because it is the edifice of the frauds worldwide. So, well, anyone considering taking on such a proceeding must bear that in mind.
Got it. It's a good caveat, I think. Okay, so maybe what else can you say about the aims or goals of UCT, and then how would you advise somebody to follow up, learn more about it, or if they're interested in pursuing some of these measures, how would they go about doing that?
Okay, great questions. So, first and foremost, the best way to start with all things UCT is to read or listen to or both the UCT Treaty. That's the Treaty of Universal Community Trust, which you can find very easily at the Universal Community Trust website. Just search for Universal Community Trust website on any search engine and you will get the site. And then just look for the treaty. It's easy to find in the top menu. So
Universal Community Trust.
it's universal-community-trust.org.
Got it. Universal hyphen community
Community-trust.org.
dot org. Got it. Okay.
So what the treaty lays out is 12 aims and objectives, among other things, but the 12 aims and objectives. They encompass everything from the abolition of usury to the abolition of all forms of toxic pollution for the earth. We also lay down the mechanics for the credit-based system and how we can put together an infrastructure that will allow it to be possible legally. So, in other words, the treaty lays down the legal or lawful infrastructure for all of the 12 aims and objectives. We also lay down the means by which we can all claim as free, sovereign, independent people wherever we are in the world to claim that there is a ju to claim protection from a government ju to rather to use the treaty to claim protection from all government jurisdictions, because the UCT jurisdiction, which was created by the treaty, it created a government-free jurisdiction, as I was alluding to before. Now, at this
So this
point,
is essentially, it's like creating a sovereign nation almost, although I don't know if nation is the right word.
oh no, it is. It's correct. But we created initially we created 26 new sovereign micro nations who entered into the treaty on the summer solstice, 2012. And we served the treaty upon the Queen and the Queen's Treaty Office and the Minister for the Foreign Office. In other words, we did all the right protocols and practice and followed all the right practices. And we served it upon them, knowing that under international law, when a sovereign nation is served a treaty by either a new nation or a group of new nations who have just entered into this treaty, the sovereign nation being served then has 6 months under international law, the law of nations, to lodge any form of legal objection. Now, within 6 months, if no legal objection is lodged, and within 6 months there was no legal objection, so 6 months after that, the community of nations that we became, Universal Community Trust, we had the right to issue a memorandum of understanding. And that's exactly what we did. We issued a memorandum of understanding to Her Majesty's government explaining that we'd established that we had the right under international law to proceed to implement all of the terms that we documented in the treaty. And if they had any objection to that, they had a certain number of days to object. But again, there was no objection. So that memorandum was established between us and Her Majesty's government. And at that point, it looked like we were going to have diplomatic relations with them. And because this is back in 2013 this was, so a lot has happened since then. But initially it looked like we were going to get as far as we wanted to get very quickly. In other words, first things first, we created our own passport, UCT passport, which was completely standard under all of the international regulations. It had the barcode and everything. It was recognized by the system, and the border agency in the UK, they started negotiating with us, and they asked us for a dozen dummy copies of the UCT passport so they could assimilate it into their system. And they said that it normally takes a few weeks, but we should send the passports and they would get on with it and get back to us after that. At exactly the same time, I was negotiating with the diplomatic office at the vehicles agency in the UK, the DVLA, and the diplomatic office at the DVLA had agreed, since I was the draftsman of the treaty and I had claimed sovereign status under the treaty, as all of the signatories to the treaty did, they would treat me as such, and they said that I could have diplomatic number plates on my car. So at the very first convening of, this is at the same time, at the very first convening in October 2014, of the first grand jury convened in Britain since 1933, which we were also doing under the terms of the treaty, we effectively abolished a section of an Act of Parliament by unilateral declaration of the grand jury on account of the fact it was unlawful for the government to say that it had the jurisdiction to abolish grand juries here. So we corrected that. And the second unilateral declaration that the grand jury made was that all of the statutes, acts, and bills that purported to cede any sovereignty of the British nation or the British people to the European Union were also void and illegal. And this is way before Brexit was even a pipe dream in Whitehall. So we did all of that. And on that very same day that those grand juries made those declarations, there was an attempt to assassinate me with poison, Shiga-producing E. coli bacteria they used. And I did recover, obviously, but it put UCT's progress on hold for a good long while. And then when we didn't reinvent ourselves, but when UCT came back into the public domain, it was at the start of COVID, because we saw that there was a need to bring back the UCT grand jury to hear all of the evidence that the government was committing the crimes that they were. And this is way back in 2020. So we got UCT back together again. And since then, we've
So
gone
for
on
those
to.
6 years, it was kind of just not going anywhere.
Well, behind the scenes, we were developing the financial system, the credit-based financial system, and putting together the infrastructure, but we weren't making any noise about it in the public whatsoever until COVID happened. And then, because we had together all of the evidence of pandemic fraud and no virus so early on in the UK, we put together a criminal case, a private criminal prosecution. And we set up a special purpose trust under UCT jurisdiction to run the private prosecution in their system, called the People's Union of Britain. And we ran that prosecution for almost 3 years, and we suffered the usual and expected miscarriages of justice. But nevertheless, this was a big thing that UCT did, and it gained us a lot of recognition from a lot of different facets of life and people. And in the end, we got to a point where we understood that what we needed more than anything else was to attract as many genuine nation builders to come within UCT and assist us. I'm talking about people who know that we need to build not just a new world, a better world, to make that old one obsolete, as we've been talking about. And that means we need the best of the best in every single field. We need people who would be doing what they're doing regardless of money. But we want to make it so that people doing their best in whatever the field no longer have to get up and slave for a living, especially a slavery to a debt-based system. We want to remake the world so that instead of valuing things and people with money, we value them in accordance with their actual value. In other words, it should become a competition to do the very best we can in whatever our field, not to be better than others and not to make a certain amount of money or become famous. It should always be about following our natural proclivities, what makes our hearts sing, but also what we specialize in, what we're advanced at, what we do well. But all, in addition to all of that, having a clear field ahead of us when we're children, not to stop creativity being stifled at such a young age, as well as many other things.
There you go.
Does that
I
answer
think
your
that
questions?
pretty much says it all. So again, if people, the first step is go to that website, read the treaty, and probably then if there's, it'll tell you where to go after that if there's even further interest.
Yes, that you can join the UCT, the mailing list, and someone will get in contact with you and let you know how we can help you join if joining is what you want to do. And as I said, there are people who have joined already, all from all around the world, and we're looking to attract that more nation builders from countries like the US as soon as we can.
Got it. All right, Michael, I think that's a good place to stop. It's amazing, really inspiring, and I am a little bit speechless, but so let's put this out and see what happens. I think it'll be fun.
Yes, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on, Tom. Thank
Okay,
you.
Michael, we'll be in touch.
Great. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
Bye
Bye-bye.
bye.